Production support for Earth Eats comes from Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From gluten-free to kosher and halal. Food for everyone, everywhere. Full menu and truck location available at urgentfoods.com. Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses, located on the Beeline Trail. More information at personalfinancialservices.net. And Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. On the east side of Bloomington, corner of Pete Ellis and Longview, needmoreroasters.com.
We brought them back up and replanted all around here so I don't have to go down off the sides of ravines and everything to dig them out.
Ramps, people. We're talking about ramps again this week, but not foraging. Kevin Pope grows them on his farm, just like his spinach, tomatoes, and peppers. I'm Annie Corrigan. Thanks for being here today. Then more baking recipes. Daniel Orr whips up a fruity meringue. And it takes some strength to make Rainbow Bakery's vegan cookie sandwiches with frosting and jam. We start today with stories about farming and the changing climate. Here's Mark.
Hey, Annie. So researchers at the University of Illinois found food producers will have to adjust their planting seasons in the coming years, thanks to climate change. The study measured the difference in field working days, which are days that can be used for planting, tilling, monitoring, and harvesting crops. Those days will come either earlier or later as the climate becomes wetter in the spring and hotter in the summer. To mitigate these changes, the study suggests farmers choose crop varieties with longer maturation cycles that can tolerate drought, or quicker maturing varieties that can be harvested before the heat of the summer. As alarms sound about rising global food demand, many observers are concerned that a growing trend in solar farming may gobble up land needed for food crops. The Solar Energy Industries Association says the amount of U.S. solar farms installed in 2016 was double that of 2015. Solar dividends tend to be more stable from year to year, an irresistible prospect for some farmers facing uncertainty from climate changes and fluctuations in crop prices. Last year in North Carolina, Bloomberg reported that solar companies were paying rent at three times the average amount paid per acre for crop and pasture land. The NC Sustainable Energy Association found that developers have installed solar panels on about 7,000 acres of the state's pasture and cropland since 2013. In February, one of the state's top farm counties proposed a ban on new solar farms. Just last month in Connecticut, a commission proposed rules changes that would discourage solar farm developers from converting more crop space, and a state senator proposed a bill that would restrict incentives for solar development. Then in Oregon, lawmakers are pushing a bill that would make it harder for solar companies to convert farmland. Opponents of solar cropland conversion argue that solar farming permanently damages farmland and increases rental prices. But then there's California, where solar arrays are popping up in areas that aren't suitable for farming anymore. One of the side effects of the state's years-long drought and generations of irrigation is that salt accumulates in the soil, in some cases ruining the land for crops. Now, one quarter of California farms generate on-site solar energy. Many solar energy advocates focus on integrating production with existing farms rather than converting them. The Solar Energy Industries Association published a guide last year to help farmers to convert rooftops and other unused land to supplement income. Stanford researchers are working on ways to use the sun to produce nitrogen-based fertilizers on site. And then one more story, Annie. This one is about celiac disease, which is the condition that makes you unable to digest gluten. Is a common virus behind this disease? Well, that's the theory presented in a study by researchers at the University of Pittsburgh that was published in the journal Science earlier this month. As NPR's Allison Aubrey reported, author Dr. Terrence Dermody says the results show it's all about timing. The study used mice that they genetically engineered to be prone to celiac disease. Then they exposed the mice to reovirus, a common virus that most American children are exposed to. Then the researchers fed the mice gluten. Sure enough, the animal showed symptoms of celiac. And in humans, the hypothesis could be true as well. Dermody's team found people with celiac disease had reovirus antibodies 2 to 5 times higher than normal. But he stresses it will take more research to determine a causal link between reovirus infections and celiac disease. Plenty more to read about these stories and other ones we've posted at eartheats.org. Hop on over there and take a look, and then go ahead and share the stories on Twitter and Facebook. Shoutouts to our bloggers Chad Bouchard and Taylor Killow.
That's right. And one more shout-out to Mark Chilla for being the voice of our headlines.
Yep, you bet.
Two advances transformed farming in the 20th century: hybrid seed corn and nitrogen fertilizer. But they're also closely tied to some of today's major agricultural challenges. Now, members of two families that played pivotal roles in changing farming are working to put a lighter 21st century stamp on the landscape. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer reports.
This 1947 Ford 2N tractor is the same age as its owner, Rob Fleming, who drove it as a teenager. Back then, his family's fields here in Carlisle, Iowa, were lined with neat rows of corn. Not anymore.
So there's a 20-acre prairie right here, which is the first restoration, you might say.
Fleming's great-uncle, Henry A. Wallace, developed hybrid seed corn, a breeding system that produced uniform seeds, leading to drastically increased production. His work became the pioneer in today's DuPont Pioneer Company. These days, hybrid seed and the twin innovation of that bygone era, nitrogen fertilizer, are standard farming tools. And they're blamed for some of the industry's big challenges, such as oversupply that pushes down prices and chemical runoff that pollutes rivers.
It seemed obvious to me that modern agricultural practices were potentially damaging to soil structure and soil health.
So Fleming's decided to bring back the prairie and oak savanna, two native landscapes that all but disappeared here during the 20th century's row crop explosion. Among other Wallace descendants, he says there's a similar shift away from what is today conventional farming.
If you were to do some kind of a survey of the extended Wallace family, they would be in favor of sustainable agricultural generally.
Historian Tom Moraine says the Wallace family ethic was to embrace tools that could help you succeed.
You always did the best job that you could do. And that meant scientific farming, that meant applying the best farm techniques that you could.
Henry A. Wallace found an advocate in another Iowa farmer, Roswell Garst. Garst sold hybrid seed far and wide and convinced legions of Midwest farmers to embrace nitrogen fertilizer.
It was Garst who had the boots on the ground and willing to go not quite door-to-door, but put the sales pitch into Pioneer Hybrid.
Like the Wallace descendants, the Garst family today promotes restoration and sustainable agriculture.
We're restoring about 1,500 acres of oak savanna. I think it's the biggest oak savanna restoration project in the state.
Elizabeth Garst, Roswell's granddaughter, drives us around the White Rock Conservancy, a nonprofit created from Garst family land. In addition to restoration, White Rock tests and showcases sustainable practices.
This is as good a conservation farm as you will ever see.
It uses terraces on hillsides, grass waterways, and cover crops, all strategies intended to manage water, keep nutrients from flowing off fields, and prevent soil erosion. Her grandfather's philosophy was learn and innovate. One thing she's learned is that too much of his beloved nitrogen creates problems. Just look at the fertilizer runoff polluting the Des Moines drinking water supply. Now, she wants to show farmers that sustainability and profit-making can go hand in hand.
We are conventional agriculture. We're not doing non-GMO. We're not organic. We're really trying to speak to conventional agriculture in Iowa, to the majority of farmers in Iowa.
In their day, both Henry A. Wallace and Roswell Garst did what they thought was best for farmers and the land. And today, their descendants are trying to do the same. Elizabeth Garst says her grandfather taught her not to wait around for someone else to do something.
You're an independent actor and you can do what you think is right. And that's a wonderful legacy to come from.
Even if it means undoing damage unintentionally caused by your predecessor's success. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Find more from Amy and all her colleagues at harvestpublicmedia.org. It's the foraging time of year, and we talked last week about what you can pluck from the woods. Of course, ramps are a hot commodity in the spring. They're wild leeks that give you the best of both onions and garlic in one leafy package. If you want just enough for dinner tonight, it's enjoyable to take a walk in the woods and harvest a dozen leaves or so. But if you want to supply a restaurant with ramps, wouldn't it be great if you could grow them on farms just like any other crop? I visited a farmer who's trying to do just that. Kevin Pope's Lucas Lane Farm is a 23-acre property located just off Ramp Creek Road.
Hello?
Hey, how are you?
Good.
Where did that name come from? Maybe the boat ramp that leads into the lake at the end of the road? Or maybe the road's named after all those ramps growing in the woods? Well, that's the story Kevin likes to tell.
There's an older gentleman down here that's lived here his whole life, and he explained to me that that's what he thinks the reason why. That all through Ramp Creek, all the way down in the bottoms where the creeks are, they love moisture, they love loamy soil, you know, and they're really prolific down in there. But they're not everywhere. So we've brought them back up and replanted all around here so I don't have to go down off the sides of ravines and everything to dig them out. So,
yeah, well, let's walk.
Okay.
When you look across the farm, the three patches of ramps are a tiny portion of what he's growing. Kevin built the four big cold frames and the tall fences that surround several areas of raised beds. When I visited, the spinach was going gangbusters. He likes to grow heirloom varieties and specialty crops. He takes me inside one of the cold frames.
It is what I call my starts.
I see tomato.
Yeah, I've got some oddball stuff going here. I'm trying some South American fruit. Pepino melons, we can grow them. It's going to be late in the season before I harvest them. Pepino melons, naranjillas, which are small little orange-like. Lichdi tomatoes, which are from the Andy areas. It's like a cherry. It's not a cherry tomato, but it has a tomato look with a cherry taste. Everybody's got great bell peppers. Everybody's got zucchini and squash. I don't need to compete with that. What I need to do is grow stuff that's interesting. And if I, you know, the South American fruits this year will just be, I guess, somewhat of an experiment.
They've owned this property since the early 90s. It was a rental and a horse farm up until about 8 years ago when they moved in and started developing the gardens. Whereas the spinach and starters are protected in the cold frames, the ramps are just growing out in the open.
There's some stickers in here. So this is all the ramps in here. These are probably 3 years old. That tree should not be there, but
All right, so this looks like you could start picking this one.
I probably could, but I probably won't. Everything up here, I just want to fill everything in. If you go back into the wild, it's like a carpet.
Those unmistakable bright green leaves. The wild ramp season is a short one. He can dig up plants from the patches in the woods on his property for about a month. Then he transplants them closer to his house.
And then I would say probably June, July, this little odd little chandelier of a seed pod will come up. It might have 10 to 12 seeds on there, maybe a few more. And I never knew what they were. Little white flowers, and then they will drop and replenish. So it's pretty interesting.
Yeah. Why did you pick this particular area to make your little ramp patch?
It has sun. It gets that really early spring sun before all the leaves on the trees are on. And I'm trying to just find room. If you look around, we have fencing everywhere. The deer out here are prolific, and they don't like ramps. So I can grow these without being inside, you know, a fenced off, you know. There's a few things that the deer won't touch that I found out. And this is one, and rhubarb is another that I can grow without. They tend not to like anything that really is pungent. But still, they're going to nibble and try anything. So we have 7-foot fences out here to keep them out. So this is one of the reasons why I don't have much open space left to actually, like, you know, run on flat ground to be able to start another garden area for, you know, whatever. Lettuce, spinach, they'll be decimated in no time.
Kevin is an artist by profession, so he says he's learning about growing food as he goes. He's made connections with local chefs who buy his produce. He puts up a table at the Smithville Farmers Market and does well for himself there.
I don't know what my whole goal is, but I'm enjoying it. And I could be doing something else, I guess. But there's something to be said about the start of a season and the end of a season. And what you do during that time period, there's self-satisfaction. It's incredible.
I snapped some pictures of the tiny ramps plants at Lucas Lane Farm. You can take a look on our website. Come to find out, our man Daniel Orr is also growing a patch of transplanted ramps on his farm. He posted some pictures on the Earth Eats Facebook page. Hang tight, we'll be baking in a few moments. Gary Whelpdale shows us what it takes to make Viennese whirls. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets, from vegetarian to paleo and low carb. Taste matters, your taste. Current truck location is available at whereisurgent.com. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses, located on the Beeline Trail. More information at personalfinancialservices.net.
All right, something sweet on Earth Eats today, darlings.
I'm Annie. That's Chef Daniel Orr at Farm Bloomington Restaurant, totally loving our April baking blowout. When we were talking about vegan baking last week, Natalie Ray Good said it can be hard to find a substitute for eggs when you're making a meringue. Although liquid from chickpeas does a pretty good job of it. That's called aquafaba, and we've talked about that on Earth Eats before. Anyway, that reminded me of this great recipe for meringue. It uses eggs, sugar, in-season fruit, and some nice mint. Check it out.
You know, it has the wow factor of a baked Alaska without all the extra work. All you gotta do is make the meringue. All right, so what I'm doing is I've got my mixing bowl going. You could also use a hand beater if you wanted to. Or if you want to get a little exercise, you could use a whisk. One thing you always want to remember is that egg whites need to be completely fat-free when you whisk them, otherwise they will not form foam. You have to make sure all of the yolk, any evidence of the yolk, is out of there, and that you use a very clean bowl. The other thing a lot of people get mixed up in the kitchen is that you never want to whip warm cream, because it'll turn to butter, and you always want to keep everything as cold as possible. Just the opposite for egg whites. You want to have them room temperature, and you want to have a warm bowl. Okay, to the cup of egg whites, we're going to add 1.5 cups of granulated sugar. And this is what's going to form a meringue.
And now we wait.
Yeah.
All right, so we have our meringue made, which is the simple egg white and sugar base. Probably took about 5 minutes to get nice and light. We're gonna spray our gratin dish, our baking dish. You wanna have something that's oven proof for this, and individual dishes are best. And so we're going to cut up some fruit, and the apricot and a half, two or three strawberries in there. I'm going to spoon over the meringue and mainly keep that towards the middle of the dish so the fruit's exposed on the exterior. Okay, I'm gonna stick a couple raspberries down in the meringue, and then you wanna have your broiler set on high, and I'm gonna take this over and put it under the broiler. And what we're gonna do is we're just going to kind of keep this down on a lower level. We want the fruit to get slightly warm, and we're gonna cook this until the meringue really starts to get brown and caramelizes on top. That should take about 3 to 5 minutes. And you can see that it's starting to...
Oh, that went from white to brown in no time.
Caramelize.
You're watching this like a hawk, no wonder.
Yeah, it goes from brown to black in 30 seconds flat.
Oh, and it's steaming now, all right.
See, we've got a little bit of dark color on it. Finish this, you know, this is kind of gilding the lily, but I'm gonna add a little bitter orange sauce, garnish it with some candied orange peel and a little bit of fresh mint, and that's a really elegant, wonderful dish. Looks complicated, ends up being fairly simple.
EarthEats.org to follow the recipe. Now back to vegan. There's this one cookie at the Rainbow Bakery called the Viennese Whirl that tends to draw a crowd. It's not in the case all that often, maybe once or twice a week, because there's only one person on staff who makes it, and his name is Gary Whelpdale.
I'm from the north of England originally, a small college city called Durham.
And so, of course, I had to stop by the bakery to get the recipe. There's nothing weird on the ingredients list. The trick with these is having enough hand strength to form the cookies. I'll let Gary take it from here.
So we're making Viennese whirls, and it's essentially, it is two pieces of like light fluffy shortbread with buttercream frosting and raspberry jam. Okay, so first thing we do is we will, we want to beat the softened butter to kind of like a fluffy consistency. Have it over here on the oven because it got so cold overnight. Typically, we want it to be kind of at room temperature. Right now, it's still pretty cold. I pulled it from the fridge over an hour ago, but it just means it's gonna be more of a physical task when we come to piping it onto the tray, so it's gonna get a little bit loud.
This is a recipe he's known basically his whole life. He's 28 years old now. It's just really a basic shortbread, the kind of cookie he bought from the grocery store growing up.
This is like literally everything that goes into the shortbread. So we got flour, which is, you know, 250 grams of the flour to go along with the 250 grams of the butter. We're gonna put cornstarch and powdered sugar.
That's it?
Yep, that's everything.
He uses grams because that's how his mom taught him to bake. He's pretty sure that this is the only recipe at Rainbow that's measured in grams.
Okay, let that sit for a minute.
He cuts a piece of parchment paper and traces 24 squares on it. This is his guide for piping the dough into cookies. He's very quick and efficient with his movements around the bakery, traits he says he learned from his mom. He remembers her baking cupcakes and cakes and then selling them at garage sales out of a converted camper van.
My mom definitely prepared me early on without me realizing for working in a commercial kitchen environment. Just from kind of growing up and have been like pretty hard on me and very authoritative in the kitchen, which I appreciate now. She like is so fast and like efficient at everything she does, and I remember growing up thinking that I didn't like that, and now like now that I kind of think about it like in retrospect, I'm like, oh yeah.
Gary says he's the type of person who loves to dig into new projects. He's a problem solver. He loves to teach himself how to do new things, like make his own vegan chocolate bars. He buys cocoa nibs and roasts them, and then all it is cocoa butter, vanilla, sugar, and soy lecithin. He has 5 different flavors of chocolate bars now: white, milk, and dark chocolate, and then peppermint and raspberry, all vegan. He's also started dabbling in chocolatiering. He gave me a reject caramel to try.
And this is a failed attempt. And I hadn't actually had like a huge amount of experience like making caramel. Like I'd been, made like a lot of caramel sauce, but not just like actual like caramel. I mean, like a Facebook message from my mom was like, "Hey, mom, my caramel is really grainy. Like what did I do wrong?" He's like, "Did you stir it?" And I was like, yeah, a lot, like the entire time. Just like, oh, that's what you did wrong.
It still was delicious, but he's working on his technique to make them exactly how he wants. Okay, so with the whirls, here's where the physical exertion comes in. He fills a piping bag with the stiff cookie dough.
So we've got a star-shaped nozzle. I'm just gonna pipe it in a kind of like an S-shaped motion, and hopefully my nerves won't get the better of me, and I'll be able to perform in front of you.
It's radio. It's okay. They can't see. He's focused and clearly working hard. 24 cookies formed on the sheet.
So 350 degree oven.
Put those in for 10 minutes, and then flip them, and then put them in for an additional 7, and then we'll have to wait for them to cool, but then we can do the decorating portion of it.
While those bake, you can whip up the buttercream frosting. You'll put frosting on one cookie and jam on another, and then sandwich the two together. It'll give you 12 Viennese whirls. When I was there, Gary made it with lavender, which was delightful. He's also been known to put cocoa powder in the shortbread cookies. So you'll see this recipe at eartheats.org. And know that you can and should add some personal flair to it. A big thanks to Gary Whelpdale of the Rainbow Bakery and of Whelpdale Chocolates. Thanks also to Aobon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Daniel Orr, Indiana University's Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. John Bailey is Earth Eats' executive producer. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Needmore Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. On the east side of Bloomington, corner of Pete Ellis and Longview, needmoreroasters.com. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Good times. Hope you enjoyed it today. I'm Annie Corrigan.